Welcome back once again, everybody, everywhere in the world. Greetings from Southern California. This is Laszlo Montgomery with another China History Podcast episode. I'll be frank with you, of the two episodes that will make up this series, this is the more exciting of the two, and longer. Last time I tried to scrape together enough to offer up an idea about the three early periods of Cambodian history told in the stories of Funan, Chun La, and the Khmer Empire. No surprise, as far as who was most instrumental in writing about the history of early Cambodia, it didn't come so much from stone sculptures, steles, and bas-reliefs as much as it came from Chinese chroniclers. And we finished off last time with the French protectorate and Cambodian independence in 1953, and we saw how the shockwaves emanating out of China following the CCP victory in 1949 were reverberating all over Phnom Penh and many other capitals of Southeast Asia. In 1930, Ho Chi Minh got everything started with the founding of the Indo-Chinese Communist Party. He got the word out far and wide, and Mao's victory really gave the movement in Southeast Asia an adrenaline shot to the heart. And then I introduced you to Salo Sar, who, like Zhou Enlai, Deng Xiaoping, Ho Chi Minh, Pham Van Dong, and so many other communist revolutionaries, spent time in France. You could have done a lot worse than Paris in the 1920s if you were a radical communist trying to stay on top of the latest discussion. And after 1949, Beijing became the shining city on the hill, where aspiring communist-leading freedom fighters gravitated to for financial and ideological support. And we ended in 1965 with Salo Sar's visit, first to Vietnam, and then to China. And following the recognition received at the Geneva Conference as head of state, Norodom Sihanouk, at that time, was ruling Cambodia as its political leader, abdicating as king in favor of his father and launching his own political platform and movement called Sankum, the Popular Socialist Community. And wearing this mantle, he controlled Cambodian politics and government. The Sankum period under Sihanouk lasted 1955 to 1970. It was remembered by many as a time of deadly political repression where a lot of boxes got checked on the long list of human rights abuses. It was also a very corrupt time where those well-placed in the chain of command enjoyed nice windfalls. Sihanouk, despite his benign appearance and what people thought of him when they met him, ran a terror state as vicious as any of his competitors. Those in Sihanouk's gun sights were any and all opposers to his regime, of which the leftists led the charge. A lot of Cambodian communists and sympathizers were silenced in very brutal ways. That aside, Sihanouk was able to push through many agricultural and other economic reforms that had an undeniably positive effect on the more than 90% of rural farmers. Despite all the bad press, historians agree Sihanouk genuinely and sincerely was trying to lift Cambodia up. 1965 in China, as most of you know from past CHP episodes and from your own vast reservoir of knowledge, was just before Mao launched the Cultural Revolution on May 16, 1966. In 1965, when Salo Sar was doing his stint in China, post-Great Leap Forward, post-famine, it was a politically very scary time at the top levels of power. Mao was making his comeback, and though he didn't pull the trigger till the following year, by 1965, anyone paying attention knew Mao was up to something. Thanks to Sihanouk's relentless pressure on suspected communists in his kingdom, they had all gotten the hint and vacated the cities and migrated to the hidden parts of Cambodia where they trained and learned all about the doctrine and strategies coming from their patrons in the PRC. Salo Sar didn't meet Chairman Mao on his 1965 visit, but he, like other visiting revolutionary comrades, got the full indoctrination course and all the trappings. And so began the special relationship between Salo Sar and his political, military, and financial backers in the PRC. Most of you know Salo Sar was Pol Pot, brother number one. So he figures quite prominently in this episode. So he didn't get to meet Mao, but Salosar did get FaceTime with Chen Boda and Zhang Chunqiao, both CCP radical leftist aristocracy once the Cultural Revolution lurched forward. Even though it would have been more natural for the Khmer Rouge to get close to the Vietnamese communists, for their own strategic reasons, on the cusp of the Cultural Revolution, Salosar, Pol Pot, he tied his skiff to the Chinese Communist Party. Afterwards, he returned to Cambodia, changed the name of his organization to the Communist Party of Kampuchea, and 2 weeks before the Viet Cong launched their Tet Offensive in January 1968, Pol Pot launched a classic Mao-style people's war in northeast Cambodia. After the establishment of the PRC and after the country was stabilized, the government sent out their army of cadres to infiltrate countries who had established relations with the PRC. Phnom Penh was one big CCP propaganda and intelligence base. Influence operations were carried out, spreading misinformation against the Sihanouk regime, recruiting young people to the communist cause, and introducing Mao Zedong thought to the uninitiated. There was quite an ethnic Chinese presence in Phnom Penh by the 1960s, and CCP operatives had an easy time spreading their message and mingling with the mainstream. This was especially so during the Cultural Revolution years, as it was in Hong Kong and elsewhere. Revolutionary ebullience was evident in some parts in Phnom Penh. Flags, posters, young folks marching and shouting slogans, all good clean fun. Sihanouk wasn't pleased with all this, as CCP organizing was becoming a clear and present danger to his regime. As the storm clouds gathered in Cambodia, with a growing Khmer Rouge working closely with their PRC handlers and advisors, civil war was looking very likely. Arms and munitions were pouring in from China. Experienced CCP cadres worked with the Khmer Rouge, who couldn't have been better students. Everyone from my generation or older will surely remember those days beginning in 1970 when Cambodia and Vietnam was always one of the top stories on the nightly news. In China, Mao put his secret police boss, Kang Sheng, in charge of running a Cambodian operation. I covered him in an early CHP episode from 2010. Kang's agents uncovered a plot by the Prime Minister, Lon Nol, to launch a coup against the chief of state, Sihanouk. When Kang Sheng learned about the coup that was brewing down in Phnom Penh, plans were made that could take advantage of this situation. A hater of communism he may have been, but Norodom Sihanouk had a way of getting into bed with some strange and unnatural bedfellows. He wasn't a friend of the West, and considering his background, that's entirely understandable. In order to give a kick to American efforts to prevail over the Vietnamese communists, he supported them and allowed the Vietnamese to cross over the Cambodia-Vietnam border if necessary to avoid being fired on or blown up by the Americans. Up till then, Sihanouk had tried his best to remain neutral, but once Vietnamese forces began using the Cambodian side of the border as a staging ground and a place to train and hide from U.S. and other enemy forces, the war came to Cambodia. And this led to those images of American carpet bombing and the deaths of more than 100,000 innocent Cambodians and other living things, I might add. Do you remember the old Ho Chi Minh Trail? Now, that was a network of roads and pathways that led from North Vietnam to South Vietnam. This was what American B-52s were aiming for. Thanks to PRC support, the Khmer Rouge, no matter how ragtag they were described as, carried out an effective attack armed with the best intel and Chinese weapons. They couldn't be stopped. And all this American bombing had inadvertently managed to weaken Sihanouk, who was already on shaky ground trying to defend himself against the Khmer Rouge. You'd think Sihanouk would be hating on China, who was arming and supporting his number one enemy. Well, he wasn't. That was one thing no one could figure out. Why was he so chummy with Zhou Enlai, Mao, and other CCP leaders? Sihanouk's friendship with Zhou went back to the historic 1955 Bandung Conference. Their personal relationship transcended all else. The Chinese leaders were out to overthrow him, clearly. They were generously supporting the Khmer Rouge. Plus, all these years, they had been aiding their frenemies in North Vietnam against the Americans. So the Khmer Rouge and Vietnamese communists, both not friends of Norodom Sihanouk. But despite all that, Zhou Enlai had been able to convince Sihanouk to put his vengeance aside and use the Khmer Rouge as the tip of his sword to fight back against their mutual American and South Vietnamese enemies. So, back to Lon Nol. Spalding Gray, he put it best when he said in his film, Swimming to Cambodia, quote, "No one in America knew anything about Lon Nol. The press didn't know anything about Lon Nol except Lon Nol spelled backwards, spelled Lon Nol," end quote. Thanks to American bombing runs in the eastern part of Cambodia, the people living there, normally content to remain in their villages, abandoned their farms and escaped for the safety of the capital, Phnom Penh. This flooded the city with refugees and added to Sihanouk's headaches as the vice tightened around him. And with Pol Pot running a textbook Maoist people's war against the government, Sihanouk left the country. He went to Beijing via France and Moscow. And on his to-do list, once he got to sit with his good friend Premier Zhou, was to try and convince them to tell their Vietnamese comrades to vacate Cambodia, because that was the whole reason American B-52s were dropping payload after payload of bombs in the eastern part of his country. And this was having all kinds of blowback in trying to maintain stability for his regime. Well, as it goes, one of those things happens often in history. While Sihanouk was out of the country, Prime Minister Lon Nol, along with a royal cousin of Sihanouk, Sisiwat Sirikmatak, staged a coup on March 18, 1970, and overthrew Sihanouk and established a new pro-West anti-PRC government. And once they settled in, a propaganda campaign was unleashed by the new government to vilify Sihanouk and all the outrages he was charged with, including the opening of two casinos in Phnom Penh and Sihanoukville in 1969. It was also a year when Chinese Cambodians began being targeted with repression and acts of violence. This was coming from a government who was lax on pushing back against latent anti-Chinese sentiment among some elements in society. Chinese schools, newspapers, and conspicuous displays of Chinese culture were suppressed. Cambodian citizenship was also denied to ethnic Chinese. And when Sihanouk got the bad news that he had been ousted in a coup, he was up in Moscow meeting with Alexei Kosygin, the Soviet premier from 1964 till his death in 1980. And hearing he had just been deposed, he flew straight to Beijing into the arms of Zhou Enlai, who personally greeted Sihanouk at the airport. And to get Zhou Enlai to do that, you had to be somebody. And over the next several days, Zhou assured Sihanouk China had his back. What Zhou did was to use his personal bond with Sihanouk that he had nurtured for a decade and a half to essentially manipulate him like a puppet. He needed his old friend Sihanouk and the prestige he still had among the Cambodian people to help grow Pol Pot and the Communist Party of Kampuchea, a.k.a. the Khmer Rouge, into the ruling regime in Cambodia. To this day, no one knows how he did it. People call Zhou Enlai great and use so many superlatives to describe his diplomatic skills. Despite the Cultural Revolution still screaming in the background, Zhou was able to focus on this matter and get the two sides to join hands for the sake of the greater good. Sihanouk, Pol Pot, they hated each other, and both had suffered from the other ever since the day the Khmer Rouge announced themselves. But Premier Zhou, he brought them together. So less than 2 months after the Lon Nol coup, in May of 1970, Sihanouk and the Khmer Rouge are now on the same team. Sihanouk established a government in exile in Beijing, located just to the east of Tiananmen Square. And Chairman Mao put all the expenses for that on his credit card. They backed Sihanouk to the hilt. Mao even allowed him onto the rostrum overlooking Tiananmen Square at one of the Cultural Revolution mega rallies he held. And a bit of nostalgia for everyone who was dancing to the disco beat in the 1970s. The acronym for this new coalition government between Sihanouk and the Khmer Rouge was called GRUNK, G-R-U-N-K. It stood for Government Royale de Union Nationale du Kampuchea. Sounds like Spectre or Smirsch. To hold up his end of the bargain, Sihanouk was called upon to pick up his megaphone and speak out in support of the Khmer Rouge and use his national prestige to urge the people to join the Khmer Rouge and dump the current Lon Nol government. And while everyone was laying down their bets on the outcome of this Cambodian civil war that was in full swing, Sihanouk and his royal family all got to live very high on the hog in Beijing. The CCP had a lot riding on the success of Pol Pot in Cambodia. Should he topple the Lon Nol government, it would be a very conspicuous peacock feather in China's cap, and for Mao Zedong thought. Pol Pot had all along been following the Maoist handbook to the letter. Seriously, even Mao was impressed with Pol Pot's Maoist street cred. Building up the party, propaganda, indoctrination, mass work, never letting up for a moment with slogans being shouted and pasted everywhere, continuous party building and trimming around the edges with purges, always hunting for enemies of the party, protracted guerrilla warfare, wear the enemy down, then go in for the kill. From the day he came running to them following the coup that ousted him from power, China had done a stand-up job being there for Sihanouk. But on the other hand, they used him like a bile bear to extract the maximum amount of propaganda value they could get out of him. Let's face it, the Khmer Rouge, weren't exactly endearing folks. But Sihanouk? The whole world knew who he was. The whole time Norodom Sihanouk was up in Beijing, he was watched by another top Khmer Rouge personage. This was Ying Sari. He, too, was among the Paris-educated Cambodians, like Pol Pot. He got to sit through 4 years of the Cultural Revolution. Not the most exciting years, but 1971 and 1975, still saw plenty of action. Ying Sari spent a lot of time in Mao's presence, and he had courtside seats to a lot of the most terrifying events during the Cultural Revolution. And when he went back to Cambodia and got to play a hand in directing the Cambodian version of the Cultural Revolution, all of those lessons he learned in China gave him some added inspiration. So, April 17th, 1975, that was the big historic day. The Khmer Rouge overran Phnom Penh and instantly began evacuating the city. All urban people, didn't matter your circumstances, were sent elsewhere, most to their eventual death, and they were forced at gunpoint out of Phnom Penh and had to find their way to the countryside. No more urban-rural divide. Everyone was rural now. What followed? Now, so many of us have read about or seen videos or saw the movie from 1984 or visited the museums and memorials or have loved ones who lived through it. Everything unleashed on the Cambodian people by Angkor, the shadowy ruling elites of the Khmer Rouge. Well, even Mao didn't go as far as they went. But how thrilled Mao Zedong was, in his dying years, to witness a living, breathing success story where his Maoist political ideology was successfully implemented in a client state. Since even before the founding of the PRC, Mao and the upper crust of the CCP made exporting revolution one of their objectives. Not the top one, but a lot of students, especially from the global south, went through the system in the PRC during the 1950s and 60s. Whether it was the violence, authoritarian ways, the terror, or the suppression of intellectuals' part, despite all the sacrifices made by its adherents and revolutionaries, Maoism never caught on anywhere in the world as a popular alternative to what people already had. But not in Cambodia. When Pol Pot and Ying Sari stood before Zhou Enlai and Mao Zedong in June 1975, there were smiles all around. They did it. They had studied Mao's thought inside and out and got to meticulously study the inner mechanics of the Cultural Revolution, Ying Sari especially so, and they had taken everything they learned through their study of Mao's entire body of work and carried out a successful revolution in their own land. What the Khmer Rouge ultimately would end up creating was a kind of melange of the worst excesses of the Great Leap Forward and Cultural Revolution. One point often mentioned in comparing the Great Leap in China with the genocide in Cambodia is that, on a percentage of the population way of looking at it, more Cambodians perished due to Khmer Rouge atrocities and failed policies than in China in the aftermath of the Great Leap. Little comfort for those who were caught up in this tragedy, but the scale of suffering in Cambodia during this decade of the 1970s is hard to fathom. By the time Pol Pot and Ieng Sary got to stand before Mao, the chairman's physical condition was a miracle of science. But despite his degrading health and long list of maladies, he was certainly alert enough to understand the significance of what these two extremely enthusiastic students of his that he had invested so heavily in, that they had succeeded. You know, after the Lin Biao incident in 1971, and after realizing the Cultural Revolution didn't turn out like he expected it to, and with his end of days approaching, living to see this Khmer Rouge victory gave Mao's spirits a boost. As the great proletarian Cultural Revolution started to wind down in China, the one in Cambodia was just starting. Let me quote from Julia Lovell from her book Maoism. Quote, "Material as well as ideological aid for the Khmer Rouge came from China. Guns and food, salaries for the leadership, the black cloth from which their pajama-like uniform was cut, the imitation leather belts that kept them up, the portraits of Pol Pot that attempted to create a personality cult for the Khmer Rouge leader, the ubiquitous red and white checked chroma, the multipurpose scarves that provided the only splash of color in the Khmer Rouge costume that served as protection in the sun, as bags, and as manacles and blindfolds for those about to be executed." End quote. Yeah, all that came from China. And after capturing Phnom Penh, aid started pouring in from China, military and civilian. There were advisors and others sent to help in the cause in any way they could. On his deathbed in early 1976, Zhou Enlai realized he had personally helped to create this monster. His old friend, Norodom Sihanouk, now living under the care of Angkor back in Cambodia, was under house arrest, had no freedom of movement, was cut off from reporters, and not living as large as he probably would have liked. As for the Chinese Cambodians, well, the good news was that they weren't a target of ethnic violence or special treatment. The Khmer Rouge placed ethnicity far down the ladder of importance. The bad news for the 400,000 to 500,000 Chinese Cambodians who were born and raised there is that a disproportionate number of them tended to be the intellectuals, urban merchants, and capitalist class. And class was everything with respect to the Khmer Rouge genocide and who they targeted for liquidation. This wasn't about ethnicity, well, not at first anyway. Chinese Cambodians, like the Chinese Vietnamese, went through a very traumatizing and disrupting time in the 1970s and 80s. Deng Xiaoping had a much less sanguine opinion of the Khmer Rouge than Chairman Mao did. But the eternal pragmatist that he was, Deng maintained relations with them. With a much smaller bank account back then than they have now, client states were hard to come by for the PRC. The foreign ministry couldn't be that choosy about who their friends were. Relations between China and Vietnam pretty much went south after Nixon's visit in 1972. Just like the Sino-Soviet split, Vietnam and the PRC went their own separate ways. And after Zhou Enlai's passing, then Mao, then the arrest of the Gang of Four, it didn't take long for the relationship with Cambodia to feel the strain. By 1979, the lone thread holding the Khmer Rouge and the PRC together still were their mutual sentiments about Vietnam. If you recall, after the Americans called it quits in Vietnam, the Soviets moved right in. Back in 1975, Sino-Soviet relations were still in a very bad place, and the matter of Vietnam-Soviet cooperation was giving everyone the jitters. China had bankrolled the Vietnamese in their fight against the Americans, and being repaid this way made a lot of leaders in Beijing feel they didn't get the return on their investment that they expected. So the Vietnamese couldn't stand the Chinese, and the feelings were mutual. And the Cambodians couldn't stand the Vietnamese. Well, that's a gross oversimplification, of course, but keep that in mind as this drama unfolds. At that time in the 20th century, there was a lot of animosity sloshing around in all directions. The Cambodian-Vietnamese conflict became palpable as soon as the Khmer Rouge took over in 1975. The fighting and violence going on between the two sides and the mass murder of ethnic Vietnamese Cambodians added to the suffering across the country. Into 1977 and 78, the scale of the atrocities and the humanitarian crisis was the focus of the world. It was very much like Sudan or the border of Bangladesh and Myanmar today. 45 years ago, it was the events we all saw in Cambodia that was wrenching the hearts of people around the world. The scale of the misery has been told and retold by so many survivors and documentarians. And to heap more misery on the people suffering, they would always get caught up in the crossfire when Vietnam's army would harass Khmer Rouge fighters. And at the pinnacle of the Angkor leadership, this extreme sense of paranoia set in. This led to a steady disintegration of the Khmer Rouge Angkor leadership as many began defecting around this time to escape the latest purges. And Vietnam's aggression in Cambodia, a client state of China still, did nothing to keep relations cool between these two ancient adversaries. This was where Deng Xiaoping, in the summer of 1978, decided it was time to teach Vietnam a lesson. Their cuddling up to the Soviets, their constant military actions against China's ally, Cambodia, attacks against Hoa Vietnamese, the ethnic Chinese of Vietnam, were forcing people to leave the country in droves. After all China had done for Vietnam during their war with America, they were seething over this display of perfidy. It seemed relations started to slowly go downhill following Ho Chi Minh's death in 1969. All the goodwill the Vietnamese leaders had for the PRC died with Bac Ho. And feeling invincible, Christmas Day, 1978, 150,000 Vietnamese troops invaded Cambodia, and in a couple weeks they made fast work of the Khmer Rouge, who fled west across the border in Thailand. And on January 7th, 1979, Phnom Penh fell to the Vietnamese forces. Watching China squirm after losing such an important ally as the Democratic Republic of Kampuchea triggered a nice shot of dopamine for the Soviet Union to enjoy. That was some cold revenge for China's rapprochement with the U.S. The USSR came in ready, willing, and able to help Vietnam in the wake of the destruction left behind by their mutual enemy, the United States. Chinese and Vietnam were in for a very rough ride, caught up in all these geopolitical events and age-old enmities that refused to fade. Before 1979, there had been a reliable Beijing-Phnom Penh relationship. But with the overthrow of the Khmer Rouge in 1979 and Cambodia transitioning into a client state of Vietnam, Deng Xiaoping was facing a triple axis of Moscow, Hanoi, and now Phnom Penh. Now, I didn't mention, in 1977, Laos fell under Vietnam political control as well. From 1123 to 1150, during the Dai Viet Khmer War, these two peoples, along with Champa, pounded on each other. And now, 8 centuries later, they were at it again. Vietnam's overthrow of the Khmer Rouge? Well, Deng Xiaoping saw this coming, and when it happened, he wasn't terribly surprised. But this was one more validation of his belief that a military response to this unfriendly action was no longer a matter of if, but when. By this time in 1978 and early 79, Vietnamese were regularly referring to the PRC government as Beijing expansionists and Pol Pot, Ying Sari, genocidal criminals, among other highly deprecating epithets. After overthrowing the Khmer Rouge, the Vietnamese government, to boost their own legitimacy, put on a show trial to try and convict the whole rogues gallery of Khmer Rouge leaders in absentia. And there weren't enough horrid and insipid words that Vietnam could heap on the PRC for their support of such a heinous regime as that. They accused China of, quote, dreaming of world hegemony through exporting Mao's revolution via its Khmer Rouge puppets. Pol Pot and Ying Sari had planned to carry out genocide and to close the country to all relations except China. They wanted to impose on the Cambodian people the cultural revolution imported from China, and that this diabolical society established by Pol Pot and Ying Sari in Cambodia was a product of Maoism. End quote. So, again, we need to appreciate Deng Xiaoping's situation in 1978. As odious as the Khmer Rouge were, they were still a necessary evil. In that region, at that time, there was no one else. And even though the PRC carried the taint of their association with the Khmer Rouge, ideologically and financially, Deng knew. What choice did he have? He had to stick with the ally he had, not the one he wished he had. Like the recent partnership without limits between the PRC and Russia. In November 1978, another partnership was declared between the USSR and Vietnam. And they both signed a 25-year treaty of peace and friendship. As far as fighting back against the Vietnam-backed regime now operating in Phnom Penh, Pol Pot was hoping to get the same treatment from China that Kim Il-sung got during the Korean War with respect to PLA boots on the ground and all. But Deng wisely turned that request down. Pol Pot would get China's help in their civil war with the Vietnam-backed government, but that was it. On February 17, 1979, how can we ever forget, 200,000 Chinese PLA troops crossed into Vietnam and began their assault on the northernmost five provincial capitals. This has all been covered before in two or three other different CHP series. No need to rehash that. Despite the alliance and Soviet presence in Vietnam, the Vietnamese leadership found out that the Soviets didn't entirely have their back like they thought they did. Deng had made a big deal about wanting to teach the Vietnamese leadership a lesson. Well, in the end, the only lesson he taught them was that Vietnam's Soviet allies wouldn't stand behind them when push came to shove. And after this period of thrashing about in the region, by the mid to late 1980s, Vietnam pulled in its horns and became a much less bellicose neighbor. Surprisingly, during the whole time he had him under his control, Pol Pot never killed Sihanouk. The exiled Khmer Rouge still had uses for him as a propaganda mouthpiece to drum up international scorn for the Vietnamese because of their invasion of Cambodia. But Sihanouk had had a rough few years, especially without his old friend Zhou Enlai to be there for him. And after all that he had gone through, living on a knife edge under the watchful eye of Ankar, when the 56-year-old Sihanouk landed in Beijing on February 13, 1979, Zhou's saintly widow, Deng Yingchao, was there to greet him. And pretty much up until the day he died on October 15, 2012, in Beijing at the age of 89, Norodom Sihanouk remained on the dole of the PRC government. Meanwhile, in Cambodia, the Vietnamese-backed regime got all settled in. The United States, and of course China, well, they led the charge against this new government that was established, rallying their respective allies to link arms and isolating the new PRK, People's Republic of Kampuchea. Some of you budding or full-blown seniors might recall on December 26 to 29, 1979, at the Hammersmith Odeon, Paul McCartney, frequently mentioned in this China History Podcast program, teamed up with then UN Secretary General Kurt Waldheim to organize these concerts for Kampuchea to raise money to aid various organizations there. Now, I'm not saying this was all because of Paul McCartney, but world opinion and sympathies did lead to some changes. Cambodia went through another name change in 1989, dropping Kampuchea for the State of Cambodia. This name was used as a placeholder until things quieted down and everything could be sorted out at the Paris Peace Conference on Cambodia that was held from July 1989 to October 1991. The French government had picked up the ball and tried to organize an internationally recognized solution to the situation in Cambodia. There were two sessions held, July-August 1989 and in October 1991. The biggest names of the day from all around the world and international diplomacy were all involved in working something out between all the interested parties. And in the end, this peace process put an end to the long-running civil war. And it was around this time that, since at least the overthrow of Sihanouk in 1970, Chinese Cambodians saw the heat begin to lessen. All the unforgiving restrictions placed on them were rolled back. And in 1991, the ethnic Chinese, who called Cambodia their home, many for centuries, were able to celebrate the Chinese Lunar New Year festivities, welcoming in the Year of the Goat. After the 1991 Paris Peace Agreements, Cambodia was temporarily placed under Vietnam protection until elections could be held in 1993. All the political and military backers to the warring factions agreed to stop feeding their respective horses, and Vietnam agreed to pull out all its troops and end its occupation of Cambodia, leaving the administration of the place to UN peacekeepers. And as I said, elections were to be held in 1993. Human rights and certain freedoms were woven into much of what was agreed to in Paris. Particular attention was paid to the kind of unique suffering the Cambodian people and nation had endured during the decades of the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. And in the spirit of that suffering and remembering the repression, it was hoped that in the new and improved Cambodia, following the 1993 election, human rights and political freedoms would be universally enjoyed by all the people. And then, not long after, everything was signed with great fanfare on October 23, 1993. There was an attempt to insert something into the final peace agreement that would call for those leaders primarily responsible for the genocide to be put on trial for human rights abuses. And this was meant to be a more credible and internationally recognized kind of show trial. China, for good reason, wasn't keen on that. So Pol Pot, Ying Sari, et al. Got handed a pass. So did the U.S. for that whole bombing thing, you know, during the Vietnam War. Pol Pot, he died in 1998, but not in prison. In 2018, they finally got Khieu Samphan and Nguyen Chia convicted, but some may believe this was too little too late. Ying Sari died in 2013, aged 87. He was charged with crimes against humanity, but he managed to avoid getting convicted by dying. The two main political parties that emerged from the Paris peace talks were Sihanouk's Phun Sen Pek, the National United Front for an Independent, Neutral, Peaceful, and Cooperative Cambodia. No need for a motto with that name. And this party had been founded by Sihanouk in 1981 as a resistance movement against the Vietnam-backed regime in Phnom Penh. Today, the royalist Phun Sen Pek is not a player in Cambodian politics, but there's still a presence. Today, real power is held by the Cambodian People's Party, the CPP, led by Prime Minister Hun Sen. As I record this, he's been in the news quite a bit, not including Paul Biya of Cameroon and Teodoro Obiang in Equatorial Guinea. Hun Sen is the longest ruling political leader on the planet, who's still ruling as of the time of this episode's posting in May of 2023. He's been at or near the top of Cambodia's political leadership since 1985, the same year Windows 1.0 was released. So, Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen, he's been the leader of Cambodia and a presence on the world stage for a very long while. And you'd think someone who's been around that long, he'd be something like 90 years old by now. But Hun Sen, he's 9 years younger than Mick Jagger, so he still has plenty of staying power left. As far as his story, Hun Sen, he fought on the side of the Khmer Rouge, famously losing his left eye in battle, and he was one of the many higher-ups who had become disillusioned with Angkor and the cycle of political purges in Cambodia. So he fled to Vietnam in 1977. Another name some of you may recall, Hung Samrin, he too left Cambodia at that time, fled to Vietnam, and led the movement that was trying to overthrow the Khmer Rouge. And when Vietnam ousted the Khmer Rouge in January 1979, this movement led by Hung Samrin became the new puppet government, and they took their orders from Vietnam. Hun Sen was first made Hung Samrin's foreign minister. Then in 1985, Hun Sen assumed the leadership of the country following the untimely death of Prime Minister Chan Si following the Paris Peace Accords in 1993. In the long-awaited elections of that year, 1993, Hun Sen and his Cambodian People's Party, the CPP, faced off against the royalist Phun Sen Pek Party, then led by Sihanouk's son, King Ranariddh. The CPP lost the election, which meant Hun Sen was going to lose his prime ministership. Well, rather than go quietly, he was able to call Sihanouk out of retirement and get him to use his remaining prestige and gravitas to give his blessing to the idea of a kind of power-sharing arrangement between the two contending parties. So Hun Sen was able to get everyone to sign off on this power-sharing agreement. And Hun Sen's Cambodian People's Party ruled the government jointly with Sihanouk's son, Norodom Ranariddh of Phun Sen Pek. Hun Sen even agreed to assume the junior role in this ill-fated coalition. Come 1998, Cambodia will become too small for two prime ministers, and Hun Sen has ruled the nation alone ever since. After pushing the opposition aside in a very undemocratic way, Hun Sen and his CPP government faced a lot of pressure from the international community, led by the Western liberal democracies. And facing this isolation and sanctions and sincere about building up Cambodia, Hun Sen began chipping away at all the ice that had formed on the PRC-Cambodia relationship following that acrimonious falling out between the Khmer Rouge and the post-Mao leadership. Prime Minister Hun Sen, he has some Chinese Teochew ancestry on his father's side. And though I'm sure that wasn't his main motivation, he looked to China as a possible way around Western sanctions. Plus, with China as an ally, well, he could use them as a lever against Vietnamese influence in Cambodia. The latest phase of friendly China-Cambodia relations kicked into high gear following the visit to Phnom Penh of Prime Minister Wen Jiabao in April 2006. 11 agreements were concluded that promised all kinds of economic, technical, and other forms of cooperation. And it was in the wake of this visit where Hun Sen made nice with the PRC. And for embracing China like he did, in a way, Hun Sen was repeating a ritual that went back to the Funan, Junla, and Khmer Empire periods of Cambodia, like those kingdoms from so long ago and today's nations who turned to China. Cambodia ended up getting amply rewarded with debt cancellations, new lines of credit, all kinds of aid, military assistance, infrastructure, and Chinese direct investment in the Cambodian economy. Chinese donations even helped fund restoration efforts of Angkor Wat and other important structures from the Khmer Empire. And with this mega bonanza in China-Cambodia trade and investment came a few hundred thousand Chinese who moved to Cambodia to live, work, travel to on business, and soak in all the sights of Cambodia's many tourist destinations. So you can say the relations between China and Cambodia are in a nice, comfortable place, and that the Hun Sen government is as China-friendly as they come. His country has benefited immensely from Chinese largesse. Cambodia is in deep with China's Belt and Road Initiative. The main BRI projects so far are the Sihanoukville Special Economic Zone, the Phnom Penh-Sihanoukville Expressway, the new Siem Reap International Airport, a new national stadium, roads and bridges, port facilities, hospitals, rural water supply improvements, and hydropower plants. And those familiar with Cambodian news and current events are aware not everything has gone as planned. The problems in Sihanoukville with the overconstruction, the unfinished buildings, and all the pollution and unsightliness of what was abandoned and remains to be completed is a favorite among China naysayers who prefer to look at the dark side of China direct investment. And still today, 44 years after the overthrow of the Khmer Rouge and the end of their reign of terror, there's still some residual bitterness that's shared by many Cambodian people. Though it's swept as far under the rug as possible, many Cambodians haven't forgotten nor forgiven China's role as the Black Hand who supported the Khmer Rouge during the worst years of the madness. These are difficult choices people of less fortunate nations often face, no matter China, Russia, or the United States. When a poorer country is reliant on a great power for their defense, their economic growth, and future prosperity, there are always unwanted strings attached, no matter how benevolent the benefactor makes themselves out to be. Critics of China's oversized presence in Cambodia make the entire laundry list of accusations of corruption, pollution, unfair trade practices that leave the locals in a disadvantageous position, and for engaging in illegal activities with government tacit approval. Listeners of Eric Olander and Cobus Van Staten's China Global South podcast are familiar with the same accusations made against China elsewhere, some justified, some very ill-informed. In Cambodia, many people are concerned or not happy about how, in recent years, along with this welcome aid and investment, China has assumed total dominance over almost every single aspect of the Cambodian economy. But depending on who you are and your circumstances, this isn't necessarily a bad thing. Diocu people, though not the earliest Chinese subgroup to come to Cambodia in great numbers, are today the most numerous and make up about 60% of all ethnic Chinese in Cambodia. Many of the Cambodian Diocus migrated from Thailand into the northwest of Cambodia. Cantonese are the second most numerous group at about 20%. The Hokkien Chinese were the earliest arrivals in Cambodia. They'd been coming to Cambodia since the time of Zheng He's voyages. Today, they make up about 7% of the Cambodian Chinese. The Hainanese are today mostly clustered around Kampot province. Last episode, you recall the Principality of Ha Tin that was first populated by Hainanese escaping the Manchus in the mid-17th century. Hakkas as well, they came to Cambodia and carved out their particular specialties and subcultures. Today, they're just under 5% of Chinese Cambodians. The kind of terror, violence, and ill-treatment Cambodia's citizens of Chinese ancestry faced from 1970 until the 1990s is all in the past. Whatever hard feelings or ill will exists, the Chinese of Phnom Penh, Siem Reap, Sihanoukville, Kampot, and elsewhere, they don't have to lay low anymore, hide. Just under a million of the 17 million people in Cambodia are of Chinese descent. How many Cambodians are of mixed Khmer Chinese ancestry? I'm sure DNA testing would show after this many centuries that number ain't small. As you can imagine, with such a massive presence of Chinese companies participating in the Cambodian economy, learning Mandarin is widespread throughout the country. Cambodia had a rough half a millennia going back to the fall of the Khmer Empire in 1431. The histories of the countries of mainland Southeast Asia was one where each of these places in their earlier incarnations enjoyed periods where they dominated and enjoyed hegemony over their neighbors, or were themselves subjugated. And in looking back at the timeline of Cambodian history, we see they fit this mold. Periods of greatness and glory with territory spread all across the map of Southeast Asia, and also times of suffering the agony of defeat and being dominated by others. But one thing all these states, kingdoms, and empires had in common was their on-again, off-again tributary relationship with China and a lust to maintain trade relations with whoever the ruling dynasty was. And depending on the geopolitical whims of each succeeding emperor of each dynasty, China either rewarded or penalized these Southeast Asian tribute states, and in the case of Vietnam, even occupied them. Well, this episode is very deep into stoppage time. Let's blow the whistle now. You know, in looking back on part one and what was covered in this episode, I just wanted to give you enough of an overview to allow you to better understand the big picture. And for those of you familiar with the subject, I hope this offered you a refresher course. If this topic interests you, I promise you there are scholarly books and papers available that will allow you to drill down deeper than the Marianas Trench. Or you could call my guy Shorty in Australia. He's got tons of books on the subject. Anyway, new topic next time. It's going to be another series, I could tell you that. One that's been requested on and off throughout the years. So, I shan't keep you any longer. This is Laszlo Montgomery signing off from Santa Monica again. Do think about coming back next time. I'd love to have you over again. And you could be certain that waiting for you will be another exciting episode of the China History Podcast.